Penguin Random House Audio presents In Defense of Love, An Argument by Ron Rosenbaum. Read for you by Paul Bellantoni. Some men say an army of horse, and some men say an army of men on foot is the most beautiful thing. But I say it is what you love. From Sappho, Fragment 16, translated by Anne Carson. Conscious subjects and their mental lives are inescapable components of reality, but not describable by the physical sciences. Thomas Nagel. Preface. It was a cold October morning in New Haven, and I, a naive Yale freshman, duly reported to a room in the begrimed, gothic-like fortress of Payne Whitney Gym. I had received a peremptory invitation on Yale letterhead, but no description of what was to happen. Nothing had prepared me for what was about to take place. Yes, over breakfast, a couple of legacy preppies whose older brothers and sisters attended Yale and other Ivy League and Seven Sisters schools, like Vassar and Smith, could be heard snickering over the stolen Vassar photos, but it was not immediately clear what that meant to me, a public high school-educated suburban non-legacy student. I proceeded along the corridors of the cavernous gym, hung with large-scale Stubbsian portraits of hunting scenes, horses, dogs. I assumed all of this was part of some phys-ed checkup, and checked into the assigned room. The lights were extra bright, and there were men in white with large cameras I barely glimpsed before I was ordered to stand in the middle of the room and remove my clothes. At which point, things began to get surreal. The white coats began affixing 3-inch-long metal pins to me with surgical tape, one to each vertebra, so that they described the curve of my spine, a process that I was told would allow the camera work to better capture said curvature, leaving me feeling a bit like a naked porcupine. After which there were sounds of buzzing and clicking as the men in white began photographing my nude form from every angle, while others used tape measures to compile my limb and neck circumferences, among other stats. It didn't take long, and looking back, I marvel at how unquestioning I remained about this strange procedure, which I learned was compulsory and was called the posture photo. Because of the word posture, I assumed it had some curative spinal purpose, though I never heard anything further about it during my time at Yale. It is now like a scene from a half-forgotten nightmare. It was not until some 3 decades later that I would learn what it was really all about, and the scandalous pseudoscience behind it, and what became of the nude photos, including mine, and why? Because of something I would write all those years later, they had to be burned, and some 7,000 remaining photos of naked Yaleys went up in smoke. A combination of circumstances had led to my embarking on an investigation of this strange, now even stranger appearing, ritual for the New York Times Magazine. This is what I learned in a cover story published in 1995. The posture photo ritual was not part of the phys ed program, but rather something more widespread and dubious. It seemed that beginning in the 40s, and lasting through at least 1971, a pseudoscience crank named William H. Sheldon, who had been influenced by Weimar-era German eugenics theories and made a splash in pop science media, succeeded in convincing almost every elite American college and university, Ivy and Seven Sisters alike, to make available the unwitting 17- and 18-year-old members of their incoming freshman classes to take part in a vast nationwide study of Sheldon's theories about the characterological implications of postural ratios, These included lengths of limbs, divided by circumference of waist and neck, etc. Sheldon believed a study of these ratios could reduce each individual to a three-digit number. It was a continuation of the German and later Nazi quest to define the physical and psychological embodiment of the master race, and those physical specimens who did not fit the profile. Sheldon was not a professed Nazi, but the posture photo procedures were human experiments that violated all sorts of ethical guidelines for use of human subjects with no apparent concern about potential psychological effects. In fact, from the letters I received over the years after my story was published, it seemed that women in particular were subject to distress and shock, even trauma, at the time, and especially upon learning they had been used, in effect, as experimental animals with little concern by the institutions that were supposed to act in loco parentis, yet made them the butt of jokes by Ivy League marching bands. How did this happen? I still find it hard to believe. From what I could gather, Sheldon presented college administrators with the chance to participate in an important advancement of science in return for clandestinely sacrificing their student bodies and personal privacy to the greater glory of science. It was only in the aftermath of my Times Magazine story that some of these sacrificial lambs said they'd found it a disturbing experience and thanked me for pulling back the curtain on the mystery of what they'd gone through when often college bureaucrats would be of no help and often came close to denying any of it happened. A denial that became unsustainable when, after a long and complicated quest, I found thousands of the photos, mainly negatives, in neatly labeled caches in the archives of the Smithsonian Museum's anthropological wing. Images of the best and brightest of the American elite, among them future presidential candidates and a past president, all in file boxes along with 19th century explorers' anthropological catalogs of indigenous peoples' bodies. Photos of their alumni the elite institution rushed to claim and destroy, probably before they could be sued. The whole episode exposed the power and default reverence for science and its claimed ability to solve deep mysteries of human nature, and it came back to me when I was shaping this book on the science of love and the attempt to subject love to scientific explanation. Not just love, but, as we'll see, grieving, death, free will, poetry, and evil. My title derives from a late 16th century defense of poetry by Sir Philip Sidney, a sonneteer contemporary of Shakespeare, who wrote a once-celebrated but now largely forgotten work called An Apology for Poetry. Apology, then used in the now largely archaic theological sense of church apologetics, discourse and debate over, for instance, the true metaphorical or metaphysical meaning of the transubstantiation of the communion wafer. Like many hardcore English majors, I had enjoyed Sir Philip's spirited defense of poetry and his concept of its being an other nature, and so I thought of titling this book An Apology for Love. But to avoid misleading prospective readers with apology, I retreated to in defense, having endured an overly subtle, potentially misleading title of a previous book explaining Hitler. Some took that title to be my explanation, rather than a study of the enterprise and the many attempts, often misguided, to explain Hitler. Akin to the many attempts, often misguided, to explain love. The Hitler book has been translated into 10 or so languages, of which the Italian title, Il Mistero Hitler, was my favorite. You could consider this book Il Mistero Love, or, after the French title, Pourquoi Hitler? Pourquoi Love? Why Love? Another way of looking at it is as an attempt to explore the question raised by the famous final line of Philip Larkin's poem, An Arundel Tomb. The line, what?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?